What I want to do is I want to discuss this thing called ministry mentality, and these are some things that I have come up with or heard other people say and have gone out and tried it and this type of thing. But this is basically the mentality under which we try to operate, and I feel it's very, very important. But let me hasten to say that it is not conclusive. Nor are they all right for everybody. In other words, I would not expect you guys to operate just like this. A lot of this is personality. What I'm trying to get across to you is that I do believe that your mentality has a greater effect on your lifestyle, the outcome of your production, everything. Your mentality governs all of that. But I would like to get into this with you a little bit this morning, ministry mentality. Now, we've hit on it several other times. We've talked about, just in an illustration or something like this, we've covered one of these mentalities. And so some of this is going to be kind of old hat, or maybe it's a reiteration this time around. But I would like to go through the paper, and here again, this thing is firmly set in putty, and so it's very changeable, okay? This is not concrete at all. It's just something under which I operate. It's some things I put down over the past year. We have groups come up. Like, we'd have a group from San Diego came up, or some guys from San Jose came down, and this type of thing. And these are some things that I would cover with them as to how they should view the ministry. And after a while, I'll begin to... Every time I share something with a guy, napkins, you know, most of my notebooks are full of napkins. I'll write something down on a napkin in a restaurant, and when I get through, I look at it and say, yeah, it looks pretty good. And I'll keep that. I'll go back home, throw it in the file folder. Old dirty napkin, you know. Got greasy chicken stains all over it and everything. But after a while, I'll pull all these napkins out, and I'll begin to consolidate some of that stuff. And basically, this ministry mentality has come out of just thinking through many different times about what are we trying to do on this place. And so some of it's come out of books I've read and affected my thinking. Some of it's just come out of some man-to-man times with other guys. Some of it's come out of some long walks with the Lord, but we'll get into it. There was a question here. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. The question was, how do you avoid the trap of people performing for you, particularly when you demand a lot of them, this type of thing? How do you avoid that trap of people feeling that they've got to perform or they're out? That on rare occasion crops up, but I think the thing that has spared us on the core team in this area is the fact that we have such deep personal relationships. And I think the other thing that has helped is because they understand and see that what we're going for is the long haul. And I'm not nitpicking them on specifics like, you know, how your verse is and this type of thing. The things that I demand from them are things that will save their life. If they don't get this squared away in 10 years, it'll eat their lunch. You're going to be on the shelf. And I think when they can see, I think they see that I'm trying to develop them and help them to make them a better person for the long haul. I want to see them come out a winner. And I think that it helps them see, although I'm demanding a lot of them, my intent is toward them, not toward my ministry or something like that. I'm not trying to build a kingdom. I'm trying to help you. And I think that comes across in our man-to-man times and this type of thing. I think another thing, too, here is a pace setter. I don't demand anything of them that I don't do. And that helps. We go out and work, you know, like, you know, this afternoon, my heart was set. I really wanted to go work with you guys. I wanted that more than anything else. I wanted to go out and just really burn up some, you know, walls or mow some lawn or something, you know, just really get after it. And I'm not going to do that now because, last night I was up to about 4 o'clock and I'm just about 1 foot out of the grave right now, so I thought I'd better take a nap. Particularly, you know, I got to go again tonight. So I thought, well, you know, but I wanted to work so bad. Because, see, that's when you get next to people. You get out there, man, you're mowing a lawn, you're roaring around. See, that's when he sees you. You're standing up like this big, white, armored-clad gladiator. And, you know, they look at you and they think, you know, man, well, that's when they can't identify with you then on the platform. When they can identify is when you're out there hacking those weeds in this hot, burning sun. You're about to die for thirst. And you forgot the water or something like that. Then that's when they can see you. So that's why I go work with them. is a this little book, How Jesus Trained Leaders, you know, most fantastic thing. But he talks about there the principle of contact, and then the principle of contact in the midst of reality. Well, that's when it really comes across. And you know, that's when they can see you as you are in the midst of where you live. And when we were talking about our home, a guy asked me this morning about bringing guys over to the home, and do you use your home very much? And we do. It's people over there all the time. But see, my home is where I live. It's not Better Homes and Gardens, and it's not, you know, this immaculate little place, and all my children run around just like, you know, my children are children. And oftentimes I think, you know, when are you going to grow up, you know? All about 15 years. But see, you know, but I don't expect my kids to be adults. I expect my kids to be kids. And if they, you know, you walk in and their room looks like disaster, well, that's okay. They've been playing in there. And but they'll clean it up before they go to bed, because that's one of the things we go by, is that, you know, they should clean up their messes before they go to bed. But they don't have to live in an immaculate palace. But when guys come over to my home, that's my home. And that's where I live. That's where I rest. That's where I'm myself. That's where my wife is herself, and our kids are theirself. That's me. And I think they, I think that, you know, just by being genuine in the midst of reality, it really helps for them to see that you're not building a kingdom, and you're not building this giant, big ministry thing so that you impress the big leader when he comes through. They see that you're just trying to help them, and you're being yourself, and you're trying to walk with God and become a better person, and you're trying to help them walk with God and become a better person, and it helps take away this performance concept. We'll get into this over in number K, where it talks about pay setter. That your men don't work for you, your men work with you. That's very crucial. Okay, shall we bounce into it? Why don't we just pray again? We've already prayed once this morning. Why don't we just pray again as we get into another topic, though, okay? Lord, I just really thank you for the priceless privilege of being involved with you in your ministry. And I thank you, Lord, that you've called me and have selected me out of all the peoples on the earth to be your valued possession. And I thank you, Lord, that you love me with an everlasting love. And I thank you, Lord, that I am in your eyes as one chosen and one holy and righteous. And God, I thank you so much for that. I know in my own life I'm so short of that which I ought to be. And I know in my own life that there are things in my life that are not pleasing unto you. But yet, Lord, that does not deter your love. That does not deter my position with you, nor does it alter it one iota. And God, I just thank you that you view me in this light. And that is your mentality toward me. And God, I just fall down in worship and adoration toward you for that. And Lord, these are your people. And Lord, they desire to follow you, and they desire to learn more, and they desire to be better people. And I pray, God, that during this time right here, it not be just a wasted hour, but it'd be a time when the Holy Spirit moves among us and convicts us and makes us better people. I pray, God, that we think more like Jesus used to think. And I remember the man who spoke yesterday when he said that when Jesus is living within a man, the man can live like Jesus in his own culture. And Lord, I just like to think like you. I like to view life like you view life. I like to view the ministry. I like to view men. I like to view my wife and the marriage and the children and my job, all as you would view them. I'd like to have the right mentality. And so, God, I do pray you'd give us a good time together as we discuss this topic. And I pray, Lord, you'd not allow false concepts to be developed. And I just pray you'd guard our minds even now from misinterpreting or developing false concept that would really hurt us down the road. And I pray, God, it would be strong finishers, not just energetic, enthusiastic starters. And I pray, God, that you'd be developing some concepts and some things in our life right now that would bring about the strong finisher, the guy who dies climbing. And we thank you for the time. We pray that you'd be in control of it. And we've asked it in your Son's name. Amen. Okay, this first paragraph up here says that training, and I really believe this, that training is most clearly evidenced by the way a man thinks. If you want to know whether or not you've trained anybody, if anybody has been trained, he's just come back from a summer training program, he just came back from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and if you want to know whether or not the guy was trained by that month at Midwestern, then you can measure that by the way he thinks. Does he think differently? And that's how you can measure it. I think actions and all this type of thing are a product of the way a man thinks, his head. I think in Proverbs 4:23, where it says, you know, guard your heart with all diligence. I remember one time that that word can also be translated mind. Guard it with all diligence, for out of, you know, for out of it are the, you know, the ways of life. Therefore, our training should be aimed at developing a certain mentality, a certain mental set. And I've listed some of these below that I would just like to discuss with you. And here again, gang, these are not commandments. This is just something to stimulate your thinking, okay? Number one is go for Max. I remember the first time I shared that down at the BSU in Norman, they all thought I was talking about Max Barnett. Yeah? Go for Max. Boy, gang, go for the maximum. Don't be afraid to demand a lot of yourself and a lot of your people. Let me tell you something. It's about old Joe Wiley. He deserves to be a sermon illustration, but old Joe, I don't know if the devil tripped him up or God spared him. I don't know how the situation, but old Joe came down to San Luis Obispo, was going to spend about 2 or 3 months with us last year. You remember that, Joe? He was up in Oakland dinking around, and so anyway, old Joe came down to San Luis Obispo, and I was really, wife and I both really excited about this. We knew Joe and we were just thrilled. And I looked upon Joe as a guy who just had a real heart for God, and a guy who was very teachable and eager and this type of thing. And so I just get excited, walk around on clouds, just thinking about spending time with a guy like that. And so here comes old Joe. But I'd ask Joe some questions. He'd been down there a weekend before or so to a little conference, and I'd ask a few questions because I'd kind of smell something, and I wanted to probe around a little bit. And so I decided when old Joe came down, I was going to find out what his capacity was. And I've done that before with a guy named Gid, old Gid, a good man. And I told Gid once, I said, Gid, I'm going to give you so much to do, you'll never get it done. And I'm going to double it. And I said, Gid, I'm going to find out just how much you can do. And I'm going to show you, Gid, that you can do a tremendous amount, a whole lot more than you think you can. And Gid moved into my home. And I mean, I dumped the truck. He had a dorm. He was responsible for a dorm. He's working 40 hours a week. I turned over all my books to him. And he did all of our bookkeeping work. And I kept an account of all the money I spent, everything like that. He lived in my home. He was my administrative assistant. All the stuff I didn't want to do, I just gave it to him. He ran all the conferences. I said, Gil, we got a conference coming up this weekend. Why don't you take care of it? Or we got a conference in 2 months, you take care of it. And he took care of everything. He was working 4 hours a week, and I just stressed him to the max. And he complained a little bit. He'd buck a little bit, and I just poured on a little more. But see, the thing I want to get to understand is he has a phenomenal capacity if he just used it. And see, when old Joe came down, I was going to do the same thing with old Joe. I mean, I was going to lay it on him. And I just wanted Joe to see, how much capacity he really had. And you know, gang, when I was in the Marine Corps, some of those things, you know, I think I shared this with you. Some of those things those guys asked me to do, I didn't know if I could do that or not, but I did. You've heard a joke about the guy who fell in a hole. You've all heard that one, you know, walking home late one night and he fell in his hole. And he's sitting there clawing, pulling at the roots and everything, trying to get out. He couldn't get out, so he just sat down, you know. So about 12 o'clock, another guy came along, fell on, you know, about midnight late. Another guy fell in. He's over there clawing, trying to get out, pulling on the rocks and roots and dirt chunks and everything else, trying to get out of his hole. And this guy's sitting over in the corner just watching him. And finally he said, you know, you can't get out of here. But he did. So... But, you know, that's a, you know, a guy can do a lot of things, you know, that he doesn't really believe he can. He can do a lot of things. Boy, some of the things they asked us to do in the Marine Corps, I didn't think a man could do. Well, when we landed, you know, the day before we landed in Vietnam, it was 130 degrees. And when we stepped off that ship, you know, we get in those little barf boats, you know, those little, you know, landing craft. And we'd come up to shore, you know, and they'd drop the ramp, we'd roar out there, and we had on our, this is kind of gross, we'd have on our packs and our clothing and everything and our boots, and then we had on a pack and then a flak jacket on top of that and a 14.6-pound rifle and a 4.2-pound helmet and all that stuff, you know, and it's 130 degrees. And so the first 2 or 3 nights we just slept in the dirt, and you know, I said, okay, now there's your bivouac. Where? Well, it was right there. And so he just hunted a little scrub bush, and, you know, that's where the guy ate that frog the next morning, you know. Next morning, we sent her nothing to do, you know, and the little frog went. And so about eight Marines took off after this little bitty frog. Right there. And they caught this dude. And one guy was holding him by the legs. And his head was sticking out. And this guy said, "If you'll give me $5, I'll eat him." So this guy says, "All right, I'll give you $5. So he pulled it out and gave him $5, and the guy just went. And he had insoles hanging all down his chin and everything else. It was horrible. It was horrible. Oh, it was horrible. But he said that he ate that thing raw. Anyway, terrible. Yeah, we had some good men. Anyway, some of the things they asked us to do, we'd take off on these patrols, be gone 4 and 5 days. You'd have to pack all your gear with you, 200 or 300 rounds of ammunition and this type of thing. And so food, what we'd do is we'd take our little sea ration boxes and we'd take out the meat can and maybe the candy portion or something like that that was really high in carbohydrate. And that's all we'd take. And because you didn't have that much room. And so then we'd take long socks and we'd tie them on our belt and that'd be our, we'd just drop our little cans in those socks, and then tie that down here. And just packs on our backs and 4 canteens and medical kits and ammo all over you. And I carried 4 grenades up here in the front and all this type of thing. And my radio man had all that plus his radio. And so a lot of times I'd carry his pack for a while, this type of thing. And we would walk for miles in that heat like that. I've had guys walking along and become just so heat, dehydrated that they would just fall flat on their face. But they wouldn't quit. Guys just walking along and all of a sudden you see him, he's just kind of wandering off the trail, and all of a sudden, And so we'd go over and God break out his canteen, and we'd somebody rip off somebody's shirt and hold a shade over him. Some guys start doing him this way, and shade, pouring water all over him, and the guy'd kind of come back too for a while, we'd take about a 15-20 minute break and we'd get on with it. Walk all day and then we'd set up perimeter and be up half the night and walk all the next day, and then all of a sudden there'd be a firefight break out and we'd fight for 2 or 3 hours and then we'd walk, and well, some of the things we went through, I didn't think a human being could go through. But, we did. We did. And gang, but somehow in the Christian life, we think, well, if we ask too much of these guys, they're just not scriptural. Pagans do it all the time. And, I think small plans just don't inflame the minds of men. And I think when men see that here's something that's going and it takes a sacrifice, I think they're excited about that. The Marine Corps, they never had just a whole lot of trouble recruiting people. I'm sure there have been periods of times when they have. Russ Korth, my regional director last year, had a little saying, "Survivors make good men." First time I heard that, I thought, well, that's pretty hard. But, I kind of like that. Survivors make good men. Wayne? Oh, yeah. Well, when I was at Camp Pendleton, just before we went to Vietnam, I was in reconnaissance, amphibious reconnaissance. Those are guys that go out before the big landing and they check the beach out and locate the barbed wire and the mines and all that kind of stuff, and where the machine guns are. And that was what I was in, amphibious reconnaissance. And so I went through a 2-week school, amphibious reconnaissance school. And by the way, the first day we started off with our exercises, and how many repetitions we did? 100. That was our first day. And you do 100 push-ups. And then you roll over and you do 100 of these. And that was the first day. And then they said, "Okay, men, let's head for the pool." So we'd go to the swimming pool. And it was cold, it was kind of cold. And the guy said, "Well, don't worry, it's heated, So we all dove in and just freezing. And we came out and he was laughing. He said, "It's heated, all right, body heat. Get in there, And so we warmed up by swimming 35 laps around the outside diameter of that pool. That's warm-up. So then we had 3 guys who couldn't even swim. You believe that? This guy had this big black fellow from Alabama. He said, "I can't swim, Sergeant." He said, "You will." And he did. Around that pool. And every time you went by the sergeant, you yelled out your number. And when you'd gone around 35 times, and you'd get out. That was warm-ups. And see, the fact that the guy couldn't swim, it didn't matter. You swim. And he did. And the guy just learned how to swim. He had to. And so then we, some of the things they did, they took us out toward the end of the two-week school, and they took us out in the ocean, and we had this assignment. And we had to go in and box out this beach and figure out the beach gradient. In other words, when the landing craft can't come into a beach, if here's the kind of the beach, you know, the beach along here, you know, in the sand, and that's how it kind of looks, you know, and it's kind of a little slope to it and everything. Well, see, the ground keeps going, you know. And so the ground kind of goes on out here, and this is the water, you know, like that. Well, see, this beach slopes at a certain angle out here and gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And so what they want to know is, how does this look? So when the landing craft come in to drop them in and the tanks and this type of thing, where are they going to hit? And so this thing could go out here a ways and then kind of have a little sandbar and then drop out. And here's this landing craft coming in, and he hangs up 50 yards offshore. And the water here is 10 feet deep. So this guy gets out and takes three steps, and he's 10 feet over his head. And the tank goes completely under this kind of, so they have to know that. So we go in and do that at night and find out what that is. And so we had all of our gear, these big reels with 300 and 400 yards of twine on them and stuff like this. And a guy would go out, and one guy would swim up, tie this string on him, and he'd swim up, and he'd lay right in the surf. And then two other guys would start backing out 300 yards out in the ocean. And every 25 yards, he'd let down a string that had knots tied in it, every foot. So he lets this thing down, he'd count. And then he had a plastic thing with a grease pencil, and he'd just write it down, and he'd just write 3. He'd let that thing down, you know. Then he'd go out another 25 feet, and he'd let it down to 8. And then we'd go back, when we got all this information, we could go back and plot on a piece of graph paper exactly that beach gradient underwater. And we knew exactly where to land and all this type of thing. And we'd do a 300-yard section wide every 25 feet, and we'd go 300 yards out. Well, all this gear we carried on our backs. And so they dropped us off a couple of miles out in the ocean one night, about 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock it was. And said, okay, you guys swim in and box out the beach. Check out the beach gradient. Okay? And so they dropped us off, and the water was colder than a mother-in-law's kiss, you know, just freezing cold. And we dropped us off, and oh, it was cold. And so one guy, Corporal Fox was his name, little black guy, just as wiry and tough as they come. He's a corporal, one of our squad leaders. When he jumped off the landing craft that we were in, then he lost one of his flippers. And so he only had one fin. And he said, Lieutenant, I lost my fin. And so I swam over to him, and it's 11 o'clock at night, I can't see a thing, you know, but as you go through the water, you can see the fluorescent. You know, I swam over to the guy, and I said, well, what's the matter? Can you find it? And he said, no, man, it fell off as soon as I hit the water, and I couldn't get it. So I said, well, can you make it? He said, yeah, I think I can make it. So the guy swam all that night with just one leg, one fin. And so we swam for 2 hours and 15 minutes to get to that beach with all that gear on our backs. And we had swim buddies. Everybody had a partner so you could take care of each other, you know. One guy gets in trouble. And my swim partner was a guy named Corporal Sepulstra. Big dude, man. He was built like Superman. And he was my swim buddy. And strong dude, you know. Well, during the night, I got cramps in my leg. And eventually, I got cramps in my legs 3 times that night swimming in. And because it's cold, and man, we get so tired. But I was swimming in, and one time I got cramps in my leg. I said, Sepulstra, I got a cramp in my right leg. So he reached underwater and grabbed my leg. And took his knuckle like that, you know, you hit the cramp, and bah, you know, and I said, ooh, wrong leg. And he had the wrong leg. Hell, my leg. So anyway, well, we swam on in that night, and we boxed the whole thing out. And we got all that done. See, we got into the beach 2 hours and, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes later, we finally got to the beach. And then, you know, and all this time you got your gear and you got your rifle and everything in case you have trouble, see. I mean, we practice like it's a real thing. I mean, we'll actually leave our rifles in the boat, you know, because this is take your rifles with you. And so we swam in, we did all this thing, boxed out the beach and everything, and this takes about an hour and a half or something like this. We finally got all that done, and then we swam back. So I think we got in that morning about 4 o'clock, got in the morning, and we swam, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours in the middle of the night and did all that work. Well, you know, if a guy would come along to me and he'd say, hey, Chuck, why don't we go out and swim in the ocean for 4 or 5 hours in the middle of the night? I mean, you're out of your head. But, you know, they didn't even hesitate to tell us to do that. They used to go out, they'd say, okay, now here's what we're going to do. We're on the beach here. I want you to swim out. You see that buoy out there? Swim out to the buoy, and then circle that buoy, and then you swim down to the next one. And so we'd say, where's the next one? That's a mile down there. Just swim, you'll find it. And so that's what we do. And we'd race. You'd have to race. And then you were graded on who came in first and second and third and this type of thing. And we raced for miles. We'd swim down in a mile, turn around, swim back, and then swim back into the beach. Then when we all finally got back to the beach, we'd run 3 miles with our boots on through the sand. And they, you know, they didn't say, you know, you guys really did a good job. Man, we've had a good day, hard day. Let's kind of call it quits early, huh? Never entered their mind. See, the thing about it is, gang, is they were training for war. And they wanted the best. And they were trying to equip us to come out as winners. They didn't want us to go over there and all get killed. They want us to go over and come out as winners. But see, sometimes in Christian life, I don't think we train people to be winners. I think we train people to lose. I don't think we equip them. But more again, go for Max. Demand a lot of yourself, demand a lot of your men. And I'm not telling you to live in sin. I'm not telling you to lose sleep, not to eat right, don't get any recreation, never read a book, etc., etc. I'm not, you know, we've already covered that concept. But I'm gang, I'm just asking, just determine honestly what you feel like you can do and get after it. And you know, I've got a little saying down here, the one I've shared with you before. You know, a man will never know how much he can do until he enthusiastically attempts more than he can possibly get done. I love that. Boy, gang, don't be afraid to stretch yourself. Don't be afraid to stretch your men. And I would really think, I'd really try to discern the ability to determine what a man's capacity really is. Generally, a man will underestimate his capacity. Your team image should be one of dedication and sacrifice. If a guy desires to join your team, he ought to know in the back of his mind that it's going to be the turning point in his life. You know, I just shared with you that little illustration, you know, about the gang that came down and helped me get ready. Well, I'll tell you, gang, that I cannot tell you what that communicated to me about their mentality and their concept of, you know, we're in this thing together, you know, sink or swim, we're in this thing together. And here's Chuck. He's got a lot to get done. Therefore, I've got a lot to get done. Yeah, but it's going to cost you a lot of sleep. I've got a lot to get done. It's going to cost you some sacrifice. I have got a lot to get done. There's Chuck. He's got a lot to get done. I have got a lot to get done. And your whole team image should be one of dedication and sacrifice, a willingness to pay a price. And boy, when those guys, you know, Bob was with us when we went to Taft and worked in that cotton field. Gang, I cannot express to you in words the feeling, the numbness, and the ache, and the agony that we experienced about 3 o'clock that afternoon. And from 3 to 7 that day, that last 4 hours, was pure willpower. I mean, every bone in my body was aching. And I knew that we could quit. But I made up my mind I would not go in until he went in. When that farmer says, "Hey, gang, man, I'm ready to go home," then I say, "Well, okay." I'd say that. But man, I tell you, as long as he was out there dinking around and working, I would be out there changing those nozzles and walking up row after row after row after row until he blew the whistle. If I fell on my face, I would not quit. And gang, and you know what? Nobody behind me quit either. Zeke Zepp was so sick, he was about to regurgitate. The guy was sick. Bob got sick. You know, he wasn't used to that valley heat, and he got sick, but he didn't quit. Man, we just, at the end of the day, we're all out there, keep going, you know. Just plugging right on. Nobody quit. And I can't express to you the agony that we went through that day. But gang, when you got that kind of people with you, then you're not only building good people, but you're recruiting good people. And they'll be building good people. And gang, the thing is we're trying to develop people who are going to finish as winners. Man, they're going to go across the finish line as winners. They're going to be world-conquering people, world-changing people. Not this little dilly-dally guy that says, "Well, I'm teaching a Sunday school class. That's about all I can do." Good night. Let's think about, you know, this little light of mine. This little light of mine. I really don't believe that God is very interested in your little light. I think he's extremely interested in his big light. And I do think that he wants his light to shine. And the Christian image in this area, boy, is very poor, gang. If you'll ask the average sharp businessman downtown what he thinks of the average pastor, it won't be a good concept. And one of the things that they consistently come... I ask guys, what do you think? One of the things they consistently come across with is that the clergy is basically lazy. They don't really hit it. Now, I know some clergy that that's not true of. Man, they do hit it. But there's been enough example that the non-Christian businessman has picked up that those guys don't hit it like I do. Man, I get out of my business and I work and I hit it like this guy George said the other night. He was putting 60 hours a week into his business. Man, he was working like a gunner. But you'll find very few pastors who really hit it for 60 hours a week or anything like that. Consequently, they picked the non-Christians, look at them and said, man, I don't want to join that outfit. That's a bunch of losers. Number B. Capacity is a state of mind. You can do it if you want to do it. Now, I know that that's got limitations, but I wanted to stick it in here because it's a book that you guys might want to read. It's called How to Die at Age 20. No, let's see. What is this thing? It's called The Magic of Thinking Big by Dr. David Schwartz. Dr. David, The Magic of Thinking Big. It's kind of a psycho-cybernetics thing, but Bob Lewis, with the Navigators, recommended, he'd read both of them, and he recommended this one, The Magic of Thinking Big. And it's kind of, it's one of these self-image books, and but he gives a lot of illustrations in this thing. And he has a chapter entitled Capacity as a State of Mind. Talks about this bank executive. This president of the bank had three or four guys that worked for him, and one of them quit. He just quit, you know, suddenly. And so the guy came to his three other men. He says, listen, can you take over this guy's duties till we get somebody else? The guy says, man, I'm booked. I take home work at night. I work hard all day, and I'm still behind. How can I take any more? Went to the next guy, same story. Went to the third guy. This guy says, well, he says, man, I don't know. Hey, let me give some thought about it. And so after everybody went home that night, he took out his piece of paper, and he wrote down everything he was responsible for and everything he was doing. And he tried to consolidate some of it and economize and work out a system that he could get it done faster. And what could he delegate, or what could he ask his secretary to take care of, and this type of thing. And he went to the guy the next day, and he said, you know, I think I can take some of it. And so the guy here said, well, listen, here, take it and do as much as you can. You're the only guy that will even try. So the guy took that, and he worked at it, and he organized it, and he just disciplined himself and thought through on how he could do it better and faster, and this type of thing. And after a while, the guy was doing both jobs efficiently. Pretty soon after that, he got a tremendous raise in salary and a promotion. Now, here's a guy that was doing his job, and he was booked. Man, he was working all day long. He'd take work home with him occasionally at night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, he got twice that much, and he got it done. He still got it done. He organized it a little differently. He cut it here. He economized here. He got a little more efficient here. He worked at this, blah, 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 delegated a little of this, et cetera, et cetera. He's doing twice as much. Capacity basically is a state of mind. Gang, you don't realize how much you can do. Personal sacrifice. Train your people to be sacrificial. In the movie Patton, there's a scene there where the Germans counterattacked. It was the dead of the winter of 44, I think it was. They counterattacked and they encircled the 101st Airborne Division in a little town called Bastion. And the battle was known as the Battle of the Bulge. And it caught the Allies completely by surprise. They had the Germans on the run. They were just reeling back and falling back. And they thought, man, this thing is going to be over. And all of a sudden, Hitler and his German general staff came up. By the way, that's a fantastic book. You ever, everyone read a book? Read the book called The German General Staff. What a dinger. But Hitler and the German general staff came up with this concept of a counterattack. And they were going to counterattack, push the Allies back, and then sue for a peace. They counterattacked, completely encircled the whole 101st Airborne Division, the whole joking place. Well, the commanding general would not surrender, and they were going to try to, they sat down, they called all the generals in, and they said, now what are we going to do to get some help to this guy? And in the movie, Patton had kind of figured out what the meeting was probably going to be about. He was sitting there looking at the map, trying to figure out, now what are they calling a meeting for, and et cetera, et cetera, and he kind of figured it out. So he told his men to get ready, get an operations plan going and a movement plan going so that we can move about three or four divisions. See, a division, gang, is about 12,000 men and equipment. So when you say, let's move 48,000 men and equipment, you don't just say, okay, let's go. You know, they're scattered over 50 miles and the stuff. Well, anyway, so he says, get ready, get the operation order, and I'm going to the meeting. So he goes to the meeting, and sure enough, that's what it is. The Germans have counterattacked. And so he says, listen, can anybody get over there and help them? They go around the table. Nobody can. So he comes to Pat and he says, I can be there in 4 days with four divisions. It's 100 miles away. So the guy says, you're out of your mind. You can't do that. He says, yes, I can. He said, I can be there in 4 days with four divisions. He said, you're out of your mind. You can't expect men to walk night and day in freezing cold weather and get there and be an effective fighting unit. You can't expect your men to do that. And Pat said, yes, I can. I trained them that way. Well, I went right through the roof. Because, see, gang, your men will do what you've trained them to do. And sure enough, they did that. They walked, day and night and sludged through the snow and fought battles on the way and skirmishes here and there. And they got there and they relieved the 101st Airborne Division, broke the German counterattack, and the war was only a few months away from being over. Yes, they can. I trained them to be that way. Oh, I love that. The error should be one of commitment, devotion to duty, personal sacrifice are the norm versus the exception. The image of the Christian community is one of long on demanding and one of short on sacrifice. Leroy walked into a restaurant one day, it was one Sunday afternoon about 2 o'clock. No, it was one Sunday morning, and the waitress happened to be coming by. It was right after lunch, and as she set the stuff down on the table, she looked up and there were a bunch of people coming through the door, and she said, "Well, here comes that church crowd." And that's kind of Leroy. He's a Christian. He said, "What do you mean, here comes that church crowd?" He said, "Well, every Sunday afternoon they come in here and they demand this and they want this and they want that and they want this way and they leave the stingiest tips of anybody." She turned and walked off. How'd you like to have that image? Long on demanding and short on giving. Here comes that church crowd. Lord, gang, what is your image? What is your image? Not a willingness, but an eagerness to serve. Okay, the third thing is self-development. Know yourself very, very well, including what areas need more than average personal attention, and work on one area at a time. Lord, gang, figure out where you are, where you need help, and get after it. You can read books. You can seek counsel. You can listen to tapes. You can go to God and say, "Listen, I got this problem, and man, would you please help me on that?" But gang, always be developing yourself. Always be working on becoming a better man. Yes.
As you are working through your priorities, your goals, and objectives, and you list my responsibilities, my relationship with God, with my wife, and children, where do you plug in
self-development?
Personal development?
Well, personal development kind of it comes along in the lower part of the scale, except I cannot negate it or treat it too lightly, because what I have to offer depends on my personal development. And see, what I have to do is I have to adjust my schedule. If I want to read some books on leadership, then I'm going to say, well, the last 15 minutes before I go to bed, I'm going to read. And if that doesn't work, I'll say, okay, during my lunch hours, I'm going to get my little bag lunch and head out to the park, and it's going to be me and my bag lunch and my book, and for an hour I'm going to read every day at lunch. And I try to work that in so I can get my time in personal development. Because to me, it's a little more critical. On my priority list, it's down a little bit lower. It's down around about ministry, down in there. Because what I am depends on what I'm doing and how I'm developing. And see, Scotty is a strong guy on this, really. But he just makes himself a very available, usable individual. He has I was at a training program 2 summers ago. Up at Multnomah, there's another one over on the other side of town called the Portland Inner City Program. And I went over and see those guys, and I was talking with a guy named Jerry Swanson and getting some time with Jerry. And I said, "Well, Jerry, how's this going?" And he said, "Boy, this guy Mike Kotucky is heading up the program. This guy Mike Kotucky, he's a really good guy." I said, "Well, tell me about it." So he began to tell me about Mike Kotucky. And then he made this statement. He said, "Boy, I tell you, Joe, I just can't tell you how much that guy's got to offer." Boy, I hope I never forget that. "I just can't tell you, Chuck, how much that guy has got to offer." Can people say that to you? Use of time, discipline, organization, cooking, personal appearance, Bible study, scripture memory, basics. The guy had worked and become proficient in these areas, and he had a tremendous amount to offer a guy. And old Jerry was walking around, boy, just praising God that he was there. And he said, "I just can't tell you how much this guy has to offer." And gang, that ought to be true of every guy. Every one of you in here ought to have a tremendous amount to offer your buddies. I do trust that you guys that are involved in the ministry there at OU or K-State or wherever you are, I trust that you're just thoroughly enjoying life. And gang, when you graduate, you ought to have a tear in your eye or something as you leave, and I think, man, that was so good. These last 3 or 4 years have been so good. And it ought to be that way. And in fact, as I thought about it further, I'm not too sure that every time you make a major change that it ought to be that way. You ought to be just enjoying life. And I remember when I graduated from high school, I'm not one to cry or anything like that, but I thought, it's been some good time. I have really enjoyed this. And then I went to college, and I left Louisiana College after a couple of years, and you know, I left a tremendous amount of a lot of friends behind there. Then I went to Texas A&M. You know, good night. That's where God had really met with me and dealt with me, and all the, you know, the gang. First time I'd ever been really a part of a gang that had the same things on their heart as I had on mine, this type of thing. And even my time in the Corps, you know, and God had dealt with me so much and so hard. I mean, when I drove out the gate at Camp Pendleton the last day, you know, I had my uniform on, and I drove out, and I stopped the car, and I got out and just walked back down the road, and the gate there in San Clemente, as you come out, it affords you an overview, and you could just see the base stretching for miles out through there. And I got out of the car and walked back and just looked all out through there and looked at it, and I said, "Boy, God, I really thank you for the privilege of being in the service and in the military like that." And it's just been a wonderful experience, and God, I just so appreciate it. And I went back and got in the car and drove on home. And we packed our gear up and left that night, later on that night. But, boy, gang, I trust that you're really enjoying life. And, boy, my heart aches when I see a guy who's so burdened by it all. And he's just not enjoying it. And so if you're not, if you're not happy and just having a ball, then something's, you know, some wires are crossed somewhere. And I've seen some guys that have even really gotten bitter or upset or mad or whatever you'd say here because the ministry was not allowing them to enjoy life. Can you imagine that? Oh, man, everything ought to dovetail down into just a blast. Man, it ought to be the biggest kick on earth. And everything you're doing just ought to dovetail down into it. Now, I'm not saying God's not disciplining you, and you know, you're going through some pain and some suffering, this type of thing. But the overall impact, or the end result in the totality, ought to be just a real good time. Real good time. Okay, I just wanted to mention those two things before we do get into the ministry mentality here. We left off with what? Number E. Here's one that we do try to run with. But here again, it's not law. But we do try to operate under the basis of a 40-hour week for the students. In other words, a student goes to class. We try to help guys to be either in the library or over in the student union building by about 8 o'clock, 8:30, something like that. And then if they're not in class, then they ought to be studying. And that way, they stay ahead of their studies or either on top of their studies. And this allows them a tremendous amount of freedom in the evenings and on the weekends. And gang, if I'm going to ask a guy to go to this conference this weekend, or if I'm going to ask him to do this, or we're going to work, or whatever the situation may be, I just really need the sense that the guy has put in a good, hard, honest week at school before I'd say, "Listen, you know, I'd like to grab your weekend." And if a guy is really hitting it during the week, then it's amazing how much free time he has in the evenings and how much free time he has in the weekends. And gang, college students are the world's worst users of time. The worst in the world. You go to a guy and say, listen, we'd like to go do that this weekend. "Oh, I have a tremendous test coming up next Monday. I can't go this weekend." And so he said, "Well, okay." And then you'll come back in 2 hours and the guy's down playing ping pong or watching television. Horrible. Just terrible. And since time is one of our most precious commodities, I really feel like if you really want to help a guy, then you help him use his time. Okay? And this is one of concepts under which we operate. A fellow recently asked me, or he told me, he said, "You know, I'm really looking forward to next year because we'll have 2 or 3 men graduating that are going to stay around." And he said, "Man, next year they can really give us some help in the ministry because they'll be working and they'll have so much more time." And I said, "You know, I'm not sure that's going to happen." He said, "Well, man, these guys are students. They're booked. They got their studies and everything, and they're just not available like these guys that will be working." I said, "You know, I don't think that's true." And I shared with him this concept. If a guy goes to work 8 o'clock, comes home at 5 o'clock, it takes him, you know, I mean, he leaves at 7:30 to get there by 8 and so forth. And so he spends 9 hours a day, maybe 9 and a half, maybe 10 if he has an hour off for lunch or something like that. 9 to 10 hours a day, the guy's gone, booked solid, 5 days a week. He's gone, completely out of it. Well, you know, it's a student, you know, he goes to class about 3 hours that day, and maybe 4, or if he's got a real rough day, it's about 5. Then if he comes back and studies, and every hour that he was in class, on his hardest days, he's only hit about 10 hours. And that's the norm for this guy over here, Monday through Friday. And I really feel that as a college student, you have more time than you will ever have in your life. And I don't, your major, well, you don't understand, I'm in electrical engineering. Well, I didn't study electrical engineering myself, but I knew some guys in electrical engineering. I knew some pre-med majors. And this type of thing, the guys had some tough loads. You know, let me give you an example of a guy I knew at the Air Force Academy. And I realize this is an exception, but I'm just trying to illustrate a point, okay? You won't believe this guy's name. This guy's name was Rock Bottomley. I'm serious. He had a sister named Belle. No, not really. Her name was Sandy. But this guy, Rock, he was really something else. In fact, you know what his roommate's name was? I'm serious. You know what his roommate's name was? Rocky. Really, Rock and Rocky. Anyway, and it's really a wild deal. But old Rock was, boy, I tell you, he was a horse. He was something else. I met man to man with this guy. He almost developed an inferiority complex doing it. This guy was, he was at the Air Force Academy, and he was captain of the tennis team. Now, the Air Force Academy had about 4,000 men. Now, 4,000 men, and of the 4,000 men, there were six men that were selected to be on wing staff. And those six men basically, directed the wing. And of those 4,000, six guys were on wing staff, and he was one of the six. And tremendous responsibilities to go with that. Can you imagine six guys running that outfit? And he was one of them. Tremendous responsibilities. He was captain of the Air Force Academy tennis team. He practiced 2 and 3 hours every afternoon in all the matches on the weekend and all that kind of stuff. His major was astronautics. It's kind of outer space physics type stuff. And that was his major. And he made a B in PE when he was a freshman. And that's the only B he ever made. Straight A's. I mean, he was a brain. One weekend we took a trip down to Adams State College. We're going to have an evangelistic thing. And the guy, as we got in the back seat, and he began to pull out of his pocket little scrap sheets of paper and things like this out of his pocket and stuff like this. And he had an old scroungy-looking pad of paper like this and a pencil that the lead was dull and everything. And he was racing, and he'd look at these scraps of paper and wad them up and get another one, you know, and kind of pull it out and look at it and he'd write a few more. And on the way down to Adams State College and back, he wrote a 10-page English theme on outer space tramline recoveries. You know, you got this guy that, you know, floats out from the space capsule and he's got this rope. Well, see, the theory is if you pull this guy back too fast, then he begins to circle the capsule. And the theory is it's mathematically computed. By the time he begins to wind around this thing, and by the time he impacts the capsule, he is going at a speed of infinity. You know? And so, I mean, this thing is, they sit there and compute this stuff out, you know, because, and so that's why this, when he says, pull them in, they just don't start giving it this stuff, you know? Okay. Yeah, you know, it'll hurt him, but, yeah. It'd mess up his whole day, you know? So, anyway. Well, this guy, in the back of the car going down to Adams State College, was writing an English theme on this. 10 pages. Of course, straight A on the thing. He got back and it was all written out. He typed it up right quick and handed it in. Yeah. This guy, you know, he just continually amazed me. And some old dumb Aggie like me was supposed to meet with this guy. You know, wow. Anyway, there's one other thing he did was that every morning, and of course, you know, he had classes. Most of their classes were in the morning because they had compulsory intramurals all afternoon. No choice. And at 2 o'clock, you know, that was it for the classes. So all of his classes were in the morning. But, you know, that he would spend 30 minutes in quiet time, 30 minutes in prayer, review all of his verses, and memorize a verse, and spend 30 minutes in Bible study and go to all his classes by noon every day. And that afternoon, he met individually with 5 different people every day. He was captain of the tennis team, on wing staff, and a straight-A student in astronautics. Now, gang, don't tell me you can't get things done. This guy was just, and you know, when he went by to see his guys, he had 5 guys that he met with and helped. And he'd go by to see them, and he'd spend about 15 or 20 minutes with each guy. And then he'd hit this guy, and he'd hit this guy, and he knew where they were and everything. But boy, he didn't waste many strokes. He got up in the morning at 5:30, and immediately he was in his quiet time. And he spent 30 minutes with the Lord. Then he would go someplace and get 30 minutes in prayer, and he didn't wander around and think, let's see, now where am I going to get time in prayer today? Man, it was just like that. And when he left and marched to the dining hall that morning, with his squadron, he'd walk to the dining hall and have his books with him. when he was through eating, he was on his way to class. And he'd get to class about 20 minutes early, and he'd get 20 minutes in Bible study right then. Then one other period during the day there, he'd get another 15 or 20 minutes. And he'd get his Bible study done. He got his time in prayer, his quiet time. He reviewed his verses and memorized a verse and got 30 minutes in his Bible study before noon. Met with five guys, practiced tennis 2 or 3 hours every afternoon, took all the trips and all this kind of stuff, led guys to Christ and everything else. So, boy, gang, I tell you, if you can help a guy in this area becoming efficient and proficient in the use of his time, you have greatly helped him. And one of the concepts that we operate under is this, man, if you know, during your day, let's get it done. So you got your evenings and your weekends free. There's all kind of things you can use on mastering the use of your time. But I would really encourage you to begin to operate under that concept. You will never have so much free time in all of your life. Never will you have so much free time. Okay, number F, and that is become highly infectious. And we've talked about that quite a bit already. Becoming committed to a cause, you know, man, idealistic, wholehearted. The guys will pick up what you are. And so you've got to become highly infectious. And we've talked about so much on that. You know, is there any question on that? Because we've dealt with that one so much already. Okay, here's another one. Exploit every opportunity. And one of the things I've seen that's constantly plagued us is the fact that we're the only one that has anything worthwhile, and only our activities are worth going to. And, you know, for instance, if you guys there at on your campus were to hear that the Newman Club was going to have an activity, you wouldn't even consider it, probably. You know, that's not a very good mentality. Because, gang, you want to exploit. Maybe you can meet some guys over in that Newman Center that really were searching for God. You ever thought about that? Man, these guys are hungry for God over there. That's why they're there. And there might be some of them over there, but, you know, the Newman Club, oh, yeah, that's that outfit, you know. And that's a mentality that sometimes we can slip into that can really hurt us. Man, exploit every opportunity. Break out of the mentality that only your group has good activities. And look for the possibilities, regardless of how bleak it may appear at first glance. Man, develop the mentality of the concept that there are no such things as an obstacle, only stepping stones. Let me give you an example. This past year, what's that woman's name? Is it Madeline Murray O'Hare, is that it? Well, she came to our campus. And so, sick, you know, she's going to be in here ripping and slashing and everything else, and the Christians are really going to take it, you know, in the right between the running lamps this weekend. Boy, Madeline Murray is coming in. So, you know what we thought? We said, now Ms. O'Hare is coming, and now what are we going to do? And so we viewed that whole thing. We knew a lot of people would come, and we viewed that whole concept as an opportunity. And so we thought, okay, here's what we'll do. Let's go. Let's get all the guys and the whole gang and everybody, and let's go here and be very respectful to her and be very loving toward her and just demonstrate that Christ has really changed our life. And that she may disagree, but we still love her, and we still pray for her, and we're still concerned about her. Okay? And so we did. We all went, and we were very respectful. When she came in, we'd all clap, you know, and this type of thing, and she spoke. And guys would stand up and ask questions, and the way they would ask questions, man, it was a very unoffensive, a loving presentation of, you know, Ms. O'Hare, very respectful. And Ms. O'Hare, I'm a Christian. And then to lay out a question. And the whole audience could pick up, you know, the fact that there was something, you know, these Christians, you know, man, there's something different about those guys. Well, we could have run away from that thing. We could have treated it as an obstacle. We could have fought it, picketed it, whatever you want to do, you know. But we viewed it as an opportunity. Man, what a fantastic opportunity to minister. What a fantastic opportunity to demonstrate to people that God has done something in our life. And see, the amazing thing about it, gang, is this woman stands up bitter, angry, and her countenance, and she's slashing away, and she cusses like crazy, and people see that, see? And then this guy stands up and says, Ms. O'Hare, I'm a Christian, and I believe so-and-so and so-and-so. Could you clarify this? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people, the phenomenal contrast. And people see that. In fact, we heard this one place. She went to this campus, and she was ranting and raving and ripping everybody, And finally, toward the last, this girl stood up. She says, Ms. O'Hara, I cannot tell you how I appreciated your coming to our campus. It has really been helpful to me. She said, you see, I'm a Christian. And several years ago, Jesus Christ came into my life and changed my life. And he's caused me to be compassionate. And he's helped me to be more loving. And she went on and listed several ways that Jesus Christ has just really changed my life. And then she said, and Ms. O'Hara, I really appreciate your coming here. But you know, as I've seen how you're angry and how you're the language you use, and the, basically the way you go about life, I'm just really glad that Jesus Christ changed my life. It just destroyed it, you know. It destroyed it. And you know, and there she just stood there, and she didn't say a thing. And the girl turned around and went back and sat down, you know. And here's this woman up here. Well, see, gang, you can view things as obstacles, and then you can view things as opportunities. And I just, boy, if you can have the mentality is that everything's got possibilities. And view it that way. Look upon things as an opportunity, not as an obstacle. And you need to develop that mentality. The next thing we have down here is develop men as individuals. And here we have the concept that we've discussed earlier, and that is that production should be commensurate with your capacity. You've got to work with guys as individuals. Not as that's why in our core teams and things like this, we do not have group standards. We don't say, okay, now if you're going to be a part of here, you've got to spend 8 hours in the Bible study every week, or you've got to spend so much time in this, and you've got to memorize three verses and this type of thing. We do not have group standards because everybody is an individual. Everybody has different capacities. Now, we had a guy came to be a part of our team one time, and he just graduated the year before, second in his class in engineering. Sharp guy. Boy, he was sharp. And he came to be a part of our team, and we were driving back from Hume Lake, California one day, and this is when we were at Irvine. And I was sitting in the back seat of the car, and we were roaring down the freeway. And I'd asked the guys to write down on a sheet of paper just kind of what their personal objectives were going to be this quarter. And we were driving along, and this guy would share his. This guy shared his personal objectives. And I'm sitting in the back seat, you know, really kind of slumped down, and my head's on the back, and I'm just cruising along. And this guy says that my objective is to review. I want to review 14 verses a week. And I'd like to memorize one a week. And by this time, my head's coming off the back of the seat. And I'm looking out the window, and I'm thinking, am I hearing right? And I glance over, you know, the girl's worker sitting, you know, seems like she was sitting on my left or something. So I glanced over and looked at her, and she was kind of eyeballing me, and we were thinking the same thing. And I was a little bit shocked at that. So the next week, I got some time with him, and I said, this guy's name was Ali. His name used to be Cassius. But I said, Ali, this guy was from Iran, tremendous fellow. And I said, Ali, you like engineering? Oh, yeah, I love it. I said, well, how'd you do in school? Oh, man, fantastic. You make good grades? Yeah. What's your grade point? Oh, it's about a 3.9 something, you know. Steady income pretty easy? Yeah, I just loved it, man. Made good, yeah, okay. I said, when you go and take tests and everything, do you ever have any problem, you know, remembering some of the facts and putting it all together and some of the formulas? No. Well, let me ask you something. What was your objective in scripture memory? Well, one a week. I said, well, Ali, has it ever dawned on you that that's kind of low for a guy of your mental capacity to be memorizing one verse a week? And it had never dawned on the guy. And he said, yeah, I never thought about that. I said, you know, Ali, for a guy like you to be memorizing anything less than one a day, man, you're just slack. You're really cruising. Anything less than one a day. And I said, you know, I'd really encourage you, just take the next couple of weeks and try that. Just memorize one a day and work out your little system where you write them out, you know, the night before you go to bed or something, the next morning, you know, or something, on your way to work or something like this. I said, just work on it for a couple of weeks and let me know how it's going. So a couple of weeks later, he came to me and says, man, I tell you, that's duck soup. And the guy was memorizing like crazy. And that whole year, he memorized, I think he probably memorized at least one a day that whole year. And the guy had become a Christian last part of his sophomore year or early part of his junior year, someplace in there, and he had not even memorized a TMS, I don't think, in 2 years. And in less than 1 month, man, hundreds of verses he memorized. And it was simply because he had the capacity, he could do that. And so what we want to do is help men to become to produce or to live commensurate with their capacity. Now, see, that's why you got to train men as individuals. Now, you know old Joe Wiley, he comes into San Luis Obispo, I'd expect a whole lot more of old Joe than I would somebody else that comes in. A whole lot more, particularly initially. Because, you know, Joe's already proven that he's disciplined and he uses his time well and this type of thing. Now, here's a guy who comes in, he's undisciplined, he's a slob and everything. And I wouldn't expect as much as this guy as I would say of Joe. But eventually, I'm going to help this guy to increase his capacity tremendously. And I'll help him use his time, and I'll help him to discipline himself and this type of thing. And we will concentrate on self-development and all this stuff. And by the way, gang, always keep your standards on the high side. Always keep them high. A good question to keep in your mind is, what's this guy going to look like in 10 years? What's this guy going to look like, say, when he graduates? And keep that in mind. Be looking at the guy down the road. And if the guy continues in this way, what's he going to be like in 10 years? What is his mentality going to be? And where's he going to be? And how's he going to look? And what kind of a guy is he going to be? And this type of thing. Really try to figure it out. Okay, this next one, and we've covered this one somewhat also, and that is basically just stay alive. Man, be alert. You know, we talked about this in the lessons learned, whatever number 12 or whatever it was, about, you know, walking numbly through the day. But man, be alert, be alive, be watching for things. For instance, tonight we were eating dinner with several of you, and I walked in, and we ate at this hamburger joint down here, whatever it's called, and we walked in, and they have these little plastic cups, and ask us about cups, and, you know, how to get one of these cups and things. So I thought, you know, my kids would like that. And so I went around, and one of our gang had one, and then I think we had two, and then somebody was eating dinner there with Sandra, and they had one, and I went over and interrupted their conversation and scarfed up her cup. And I just thought, you know, my kids would like that. And, you know, something else, we were sitting there, we were getting ready to leave, and this other girl brought me a cup, and I said, you know, I just cleaned out the first two. And as she brought me the cup, my thought was, you know, I need a napkin. And I turned around, and somebody had already gone to get one and was on their way back with a napkin. Man, I just love that. See, you know, so here's the cup coming, and immediately she's on her way because she knows what's going to be needed. She's on her way. That's fantastic. Man, just being alert and seeing things like that and acting on it, and oh, that's fantastic. And it's so easy for us, you know, just to, you know, stumble out and walk into trees and, you know, and bump into cars and, you know, and that's life, you know. Just life, you know. You know, it's three kind of people in this world. One of them knows what's happening. The next guy who makes things happen. And the third guy doesn't know what's happening. Yeah. What's happening? And it's the third guy that you want to avoid. I mean, as far as being that yourself. What's happening? Man, be alert, be alive, and make good observations, and be sharp. Ask questions and get the facts. Man, don't walk into a situation and see something and, oh, well, I can't figure that one out, and then just let it ride. Man, find out. Think. Use your head. Figure it out. Put it together. Jim? Do I have a lessons learned on that? We'll get to that. From this, I want to jump into lessons learned. We'll cover that, okay? Good question, though. Thank you. Well, let me give you a good verse on this that I just love. I was walking back from campus one day, and was walking along, and I wanted to memorize this section of Scripture, so I opened up my Bible, and just walking down the road, I memorized these little few verses of Scripture. And it's over in Proverbs 24, 33-34. And I just love this. This is so so crystal clear and so pointed to me. It says, I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense. And behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles and its stone wall was broken down. He saw three things. I saw a field. It was overgrown with thistles, thorns, and things. I saw just a, kind of the surface out through there. Just had nettles everywhere, weeds. And I saw walls that were broken down. General state of disrepair. He said, I saw those things. And the next verse is so classic. He said, when I saw, I reflected upon it. That is fantastic. When I saw that, I thought about that. Oh, gang, if we could just develop that mentality. You're driving down the road, you see something, and you think, huh, now isn't that something? And you think about that. You think about that. When I, this guy's just walking down the road, and he saw that, and he saw three things. And he says, when I saw that, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little sleep. A little slumber. Yeah. A little folding of the hands to rest. Just a little bit. Not a big amount. Just a little bit. Take a little nap here. Oh, we'll hit it tomorrow. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Then your poverty will come like a robber, and your want like an armed man. And you know what that means? Have you ever thought about how a robber comes? Well, see, a guy comes in and robs you. Then it's gone before you realize it. All of a sudden, gang, it is too late. It's gone. Or you're wanting like an armed man. Maybe you catch it. Oh, wait. But the guy's armed now, and you can't do a thing about it. And what he's trying to picture here to me, I think, is a situation where the guy's going to wake up and see it, and it is too late. He has blown his life. And the guy's walking down the road, and he figured that out. He just saw a field over here with a bunch of vineyards and things, and he figured that out. Again, can you do that? Can you just drive along the road or walk into campus and see situations and figure out, I can see a lesson in that? And do you have the habit of walking along and thinking, huh, I looked and received instruction. When I saw, I reflected upon it. Is that your mentality? Is that your habit? Man, are you alert and are you alive? And then another thing I have down under here is once you see some things like that, once you make some observations, you see in this passage of Scripture the guy made three observations. But see, at that point he didn't let it rest. He thought about that and he thought about it until it crystallized in his thinking. Well, I see. I've learned. I see a lesson. I've got it now. And it crystallized. Man, the fog lifted and he saw it. He saw the lesson. And don't let your thinking rest. Or if you see some things, well, then just mull it over and think about it until it crystallizes. And gang, that's basically what these lessons learned are here. You know, I've been gathering those things for 4 years. There's only 15 of them. But saying all of a sudden something happens or this happens and all of a sudden a concept will crystallize my thinking. That's what it is. And I'll hastily write that down in kind of the situation that taught it to me and this type of thing. But gang, don't let it, you know, if you make some good observations and think them through, try to figure it out. And then think, you know, like this guy, think what will be the logical and the scriptural conclusion. Where's that guy going to be in 10 years? I see some things in this guy's life. I see it here, and then I see it here, and I see it there. Now, where's that guy going to be in 10 years? What's that going to do to him? Here's a guy that's very insecure. He's always down on himself. What's that going to do to his marriage? I mean, here's a guy who goes on his marriage, his woman. He's always down on himself. And he's, what's that going to do to his children? And think through, where's that guy going to wind up? Here's a guy that just can't get control over the use of his time. Sloughing off, nickel-diming around. Where's this guy going to be in 10 years? Well, he'll graduate, and then he's going to get married. What kind of job is he going to be able to get? Good job? Respectable job? Doubt it. And see, gang, try to see a situation. Where's that guy going to wind up? And think through on that. And boy, think, gang. Stay alive. Use your head and think and be alert and watch and learn. There's so many things you can learn just walking across that building over there. So many things. Okay, number J there, or letter J. Understand and develop that to which God has called and gifted you. Gang, I would really make a habit of studying myself. Over in my briefcase, and don't any of you guys go over and break into it, but over in my briefcase in my room the other day, I sat down and it was late at night. I was doing Bible study, and then Robbie came in, and we were chatting about some things, and she left. And when she did, she had triggered some thinking, and I just sat down. And I made out like I was talking to a Christian psychologist. In fact, about the only one I know right now is maybe Dr. Henry Brand or something like that. So I just made it like it was him. And I sat down and wrote that guy a 5-page letter. And I made out like I was going in to see him for a counseling session. I got problems. And I need some counsel. And so now, to give you a little briefing on myself, a little case history, here it is. And what I wrote about is a problem that I was experiencing in my life and how it exemplified itself and how it had come out and my thinking on it, the history of it, and this type of thing. And here, Dr. Brandt, can you help me on this? And I wrote 5 pages on that. Again, the reason I did that is because I feel like that one of the most valuable things you can do is get to know yourself. Who am I? Get to know yourself. Now, I don't mean to say, but let me hasten to say that I don't want you to become preoccupied with this. Because I think real life is found not in looking for yourself, but in losing yourself. I think that's real life. So I don't want you to become preoccupied with who am I. But I think it's extremely valuable that you know yourself. That you know yourself. Now, one of the things that we do there in SLO is I have the guys take a test called the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis Test, and Helene Ashke or somebody like that who has the has been to the school and all this type of thing grades it, and it helps the guys because it reveals the temperaments of the guys, the strengths and weaknesses of the guy, and it grades about 9 different categories, 9 different temperaments. For instance, it'll say, are you impulsive or are you disciplined? Are you nervous or are you composed? And it'll put these, it'll put one set at, you know, across the top and the opposites across the bottom, and then you answer 180 questions. Does blank enjoy driving in freeway traffic? Yes or no? Or you know, they had some mids in there. Well, I don't know. And you could answer it kind of in the mid, but they discouraged too many of those mids, maybe half a dozen for the whole test. But does Chuck enjoy going out at night? Or would you rather stay home and read a book? I'd rather stay home, you know, and this type of thing. And out of that, they can tell whether you're quiet or are you socially active. Are you inhibited or are you expressive? And they'll and see, I'll have every one of the guys take that. And then it plots it out. And it grades it. And it has 4 areas. The guy is really good. He's really secure in this area. He's a good deal. Or he's okay. Or he needs a little bit of help, or he needs a lot of help. And it'll plot in those 4 areas. And I have all the guys take that. And you know, gang, we had one person in our area that took that test, and they needed help urgently in 7 of the 9 areas. The guy was almost psychotic. Well, you're talking about mixed up, you're talking about not knowing yourself. And see, another thing we'll do is I'll give him a blank sheet of paper, a blank form, and I say, listen, just kind of plot where you think you are. And so they'll kind of plot, you know, well, I'm kind of this way, and I'm kind of this way, and blah, blah, blah. And then we'll take a different color ink, and we'll draw what the test says. It is amazingly revealing. But I really want guys, and I've taken this thing myself. Another thing you can do is I'll take one on myself, and then I'll have Robbie take one on me. So Robbie says, well, does Chuck enjoy driving in freeway traffic? And I might think, oh, man, I enjoy that, no sweat. And Robbie says, no, he gets nervous, and he gets uptight and screaming at the drivers. No, he doesn't, see. You know? Well, see, that's very revealing. Someone who really knows you can take one on you. That's very revealing. But I really want guys to know and understand themselves. And a personality, a spiritual gifts. We went over to our pastor's home the other day, and we spent about 3 hours with him. The whole gang took the gang over and says, listen, pastor, would you go through this whole thing on spiritual gifts? We'd like to know what our gifts are. And so we went through this thing, and for about 3 hours, and at the end of that, each person told what he thought his spiritual gift was and why, and then the rest of us would discuss that. But I want guys to know what their spiritual gift is. What is your temperament? You know, I'm kind of into that a little bit. I enjoy Tim LaHaye's material. He's got a book out on it, Spirit Controlled Temperaments. He got some tapes that are even better. Fantastic tapes, I like for the gang to listen to that. I want the guys to know themselves, understand themselves. Why I'm this way? Why do I do these things? Why do I think this way? Now, that doesn't mean that it's right. If they think that way and it's wrong, then we need to change that. And, man, I don't buy this Freudian psychology. Well, man, that's the way I am. Take it or leave it. I'll take it, but I won't leave it. Man, I'll tell you, if it's sin, it's sin. And let's deal with some of these things. And if you're this way, well, then that may be, for instance, a guy says, man, the reason I'm so hostile and the reason I react so violently is because when I was 6, my grandmother used to beat me. Well, I can see how your grandmother beating you when you were 6 would produce hostility. The question, however, is what are you going to do about it now? And that's a little concept called reality therapy. Okay, what about now? And the fact that you are this way today, you can trace it back and see why you are that way now. But if you choose to live that way, be it understood that it is because of your will that you are that way. You have chosen to remain that way. And it is nothing other than a choice of your will that you remain hostile. You could change that. You could deal with that. You could surrender that. But you have chosen to keep that. And there's no other reason. You're hostile because you want to be hostile. You are reclusive because you want to be reclusive. You are negative because you want to be negative, and for no other reason. If you say that is not a choice of your will, you're saying that the Holy Spirit cannot do anything about it, and that it's just you're locked into a Freudian psychological concept. Oh, gang. The essence of Christianity lies in the will, and you can give that up. God, I will surrender that. You know, C.S. Lewis, I don't want to jump off on this too much, but he wrote a book called The Great Divorce. And in this book, he makes a fantastic statement. He said, in reality, there's only two types of people in the world. Those to who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says, thy will be done. Isn't that fantastic? Those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says, thy will be done. There's really only two classes. That scares me, you know that? Oh. Now let me show you a little thing here that, just quickly, this is such a pretty board, isn't that pretty? Ah. Take your temperament and your personality, you know, you've got certain things about your personality, and your spiritual gift, and these types of things. You know what I'm coming to? Now, this is not, you know, here again, this is in putty. But I've been thinking about this. You know, I kind of think this tends to dovetail into God's call on your life. Now, let me give you an example. My temperament, my basic temperament is a choleric. I don't know if you know that or not. I don't know if that's spelled right either. But I think my basic temperament is a choleric. And I exemplify the strengths and weaknesses of a cleric. I think my second strongest temperament is a melancholic. I can really get moody. Man, you can turn on James Taylor or Gordon Lightfoot, and I just get so melancholic and sad, you know, drag around, you know. But that's the way I am. See, I understand. I'm cleric, goal-oriented. Objective, you know, runs over people. Man, here's the objective, get out of the way, and either get with it or get out of the way. You know? Not really a people person, this type of thing. You probably wouldn't pick that up. My personality, you know, kind of a hard work and a lot like my dad. See, my dad's a lot this way and success oriented, all that stuff, you know, kind of personality. Spiritual gift is exhortation. Get with it. You know, one called alongside to kick, to help, you know. Really, you know, I'm just called alongside to help, you know, to encourage one to kind of get with it, you know. And that's my spiritual gift. Well, you see all that kind of dovetail, down in the calling of God. And God wants me to, you know, I feel very content now that I'm in the center of God's will, doing the ministry that which we're doing. But I'd like you guys to be thinking about that a little bit. You know, that I'm kind of this way, and I'm kind of this way, and I'm kind of this way, and does that, you know, can I see how that God is programmed? You know, by the way, see, all this stuff right here, your personality and your temperament and all this kind of stuff, see, that was there before you ever became a Christian. But see, when did the sovereignty of God take over in your life? When was God thinking about his call for your life? Well, he thought about that before you ever even conceived. Man, he had that plan before the foundation of the world. And so God's calling your life, he put you in that home with those parents. That would make you that would cause you to have that personality. He gave you that mom and that dad. He knew what that was going to do in your life. Nobody, you know, sneaked up on God and says, "Boy, God, you just don't realize what you've done." Well, see, he put you in those parents, in that town, in that high school, et cetera, et cetera. He knew that. And then along here, you're in the military, you're in college, and all of a sudden you're converted. And you think, "Oh, woe is me! Look at that horrible background." Well, see, if you take a look at all that, I think God, you know, has a call out here, has something out here for you, and it all dovetails toward that. And what I'd like for you to do is think about that and try to see, now, where am I? And where am I going? And you know, some of you think, man, student work is the only thing to do. Well, you know, there's a few of the things in the kingdom of God. And to some of you, I just can't say that God is really, you know, I don't know. I think about that, though, before I just jump on the old student work bandwagon. Man, if you're going to be doing something for God, obviously it's student work. I mean, that's where it's at. I mean, if I won't get it, it ain't in town, you know. But see, I don't think that's true for some of you guys, or some of you gals. I don't think that's your bag. But look, try to get to know yourself and understand yourself and your personality, your temperament, your spiritual gift. And I think, you know, here again, it's in putty. I'm not preaching this as a doctrine. But it does seem to me that all this dovetails into what God wants to do with your life. Give that some thought, okay? Well, let's see. That puts us down on K. Yes. The Taylor Johnson Temperament Analysis. I don't know where you get the thing. Helene does a lot of the testing for us, and she's really quite a gal. I'd call her and say, Helene, you know, can you come up here next month or so and bring a bunch of your stuff? And she'd always try to do that.
Anybody in the psych or counseling department at school would be able to have
it. Okay. He says that anybody in the psychology or the counseling department at college would have the material. It's a pretty tried and tested test. It's a very good... No, the guy that grades it, he takes a little key thing, you know, and he looks at it and places over it, and out of that he gets, well, nine scores here and 8 and 16. And then another thing, too, is that, by the way, Max, you might want to send a guy to get some instruction in this. You can go to a school and learn how to do this. It costs you about $100 and take you a couple of days, you know. But there are certain schools that come up. You might want to send some of your guys out and let them become gifted in this area. I mean, you know, trained in this area. It is a very, very good test. And here again, they say down at the bottom of the test, this major decision should not be based on this test alone. But this test does helps. It's one thing that helps you to kind of understand yourself a little better. And in my case, and as we've used it on guys up around in our areas and in our ministries, it has proved pretty true. It is amazingly how accurate it is. And immediately a guy comes and he looks at that and he says, I'm not that way. And you got to be kidding me. And what do you mean impulsive? I'm not, man. And everybody's sitting around and just waiting for him to kind of stop, and because they're going to say, well, you really are. See, everybody knows it but him. But a guy looking at it, and he just can't believe it. Then he goes off and he thinks about it a little bit. And inevitably he'll think, good night, that's right. I love that, you know. And I had three of them. I was in the, you know, need help urgent in three areas. You'd never guess what they were. Question? Let's see if I can think. One of them was this is terrible. 0 to 100, you know. And so I asked this guy, I said, do you think I'm disciplined or do you think I'm impulsive? And, you know, 0 was down in impulsive. That doesn't mean anything. It just means on the scale, you know. And this was 100 up here. This is discipline, and this is impulsive. So I asked the guys, my Bible said, I said, would you say I'm impulsive or am I disciplined? And the guy said, oh, you'd be about 94, and one guy 86, you know, and stuff like this. And I said, I rated 6. 6. So I said, now, do you guys believe I'm hostile? Am I hostile? Or am I... I don't know what the other one is, composed or something. I don't know what it is. But they all said, oh, no, man, you're a cool cat, and you know, that stuff. So they had all about, I think it was the other way around on this one. So they said about 25. One guy said 12. Man, no. I said, I'm 97. Don't laugh. Anyway. So, I can't remember the other thing. Hostile. As impulsive. I was hostile. I'm not sure I can remember the other one right now. There were three. Nervous. I'm nervous. I was very nervous. And we just, you know, almost off the charts on that one. And I looked at that thing, I thought, you got to be kidding. But the more I thought about it, you know, I said, man, that's it. That labeled me like a book. Well, I'll tell you. And my wife came back and she was indifferent. I'll be dying in there of the flu or something. She'll come and say, anything I can do for you? And I'm just dying. I'll tell you. Anyway, oh, those are fun. You can have a lot of fun with that. Yes?
How far along are you guys with your core team?
Yeah, I just use it with the core team. Mm-hmm. Now, they may want to turn around and use it with their guys, but they haven't yet. And I've used it, too, with some special deals. You know, a guy who's really kind of hung up on something, or he's really, you know, he's really bothered and he's troubled. It seems like he's abnormally, he's an abnormal situation, and I'll test him just to try to understand the guy a little better, and I'll have him take it. The last one is a pace setter, right? Is that where we are? Your team doesn't work for you, they work with you. To me, this is one of Leroy's strong points, is that the guys did not work with Leroy, for Leroy, they worked with him. And it was gang, we're in this thing together. You know, sink or swim, we're in it together. We're all in this thing together. And this thing about a pace setter, you know, you don't walk in and say, okay, gang, here are your standards, now you do these things, okay? You say, oh, gang, what are we going to do? What do you feel like the Lord wants us to do this year? What do you guys think? In our planning sessions, it's participatory planning. Everybody participates. It's, you know, everybody that's going to be responsible for getting the job done has a big part in planning it. A concept called participatory planning. Them that's got to do it ought to plan it. And when we go out and work, I generally always try to go with the guys. I love to get out and work with the guys. Leroy loves to have people come over to his home, and when he does, man, they'll get around, they'll work out in the yard and down in the creek and clean out that place and wash the car and sweep out the garage and all those things, you know. He just loves that, getting out there and working with those people. But gang, the thing is that you need to be with your people. The old lieutenant, I don't know if I told you guys about this or not, but there's a classic snapshot of a guy in the Korean War. I'd really like to get a copy of it one of these days. The South Koreans attacked North Korea. It's really something. And, you know, the country kind of sticks out as a peninsula, something like this, you know. And here's Seoul. Seoul, Korea is way up here. And at this time now, you know, here's the, what is it, 38th parallel? 38th parallel. But Seoul's quite a bit north, and here's the kind of the Chosin Reservoir and all this type of thing. But anyway, what happened? And right out here on the coast, a little town called Wonsan? Well, anyway. Anyway, what happens is the North Koreans attacked down across the 30th parallel and came in, and the 8th Army was over in Japan at the time, so they were rushed over. It was an occupational army in Japan, and they were rushed over to South Korea to stem this North Korean invasion. And what happens is they begin to fall back, and they fall back. By the way, gang, the 8th Army, this is a very horrible, ugly spot in the history of the Army, but there's a reason for it. The 8th Army was an occupational army. The guys that had fought the war in the Pacific had all gone home. And these were fresh, and they were occupational troops, untried and untested. They were, you know, well, the war is over, you know, and see, this happened in 1950, June of 1950. And there, you know, the guys had gone back home and everything, and these were the fresh green troops and the new breed and untried and untested. And they were in Japan, and so they rushed them over to Korea. They had some people here, but they rushed to reinforcements. And these people, gang, would throw down their helmets and their packs and their rifles and run without firing a shot. Untried in battle. Untried and untested. And but see, gang, that's why you don't ever turn over your good jobs, your most important things, to your untried troops. Man, select your veterans. For your big jobs, take your veterans. Well, anyway, these guys fell back. Finally, they got way down here to a little bitty spot, just a few square miles of land called the Pusan. No, the whole thing's called the Pusan Perimeter. What was this called down here? A little area of ground. Just a little bitty area of ground. And boy, their backs were to the wall. Well, the Marine Corps sent over in the United States, you know, and so they send telegrams to MacArthur and said, listen, we'll come help you. We'll come. And, well, see, there had been such a tremendous demobilization that, man, the Marine Corps didn't even have a good division. And so I forget the commandant at the time, but he telegraphed MacArthur, and he said, now listen, he said, I can have a fighting division and a fighting air wing ready in 6 weeks if you'll give me the word. And so MacArthur wired the chief of staff back in the United States and said, send me the Marine Division, the 1st Marine Division, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Peleliu, you know, all those, you know, veterans, you know. I mean, guys that had been through the mill, Iwo Jima, the whole bit, you know. So he says, send me, he said, send me the 1st Marine Division. So they cranked up, went into, and these guys were tried and tested. They went into some quick training, got the troops, and loaded aboard the ships and took off. They came over and they landed, and they used them to plug some gaps here until they kind of stabilized. And then they loaded aboard ships and sailed up this little narrow strait up through here to a little town called Wonsan. I think it was Wonsan. And they got up there. I just love this stuff, you know. And they sailed around here, got up there, and the native says, you have got 2 hours. The tide rises and falls 22 feet. And he says, our ships will bottom out in this little strait. And he says, we can give you naval gunfire in 2 hours. You have got 2 hours to take that town and establish a beachhead. They took it in 57 minutes. In 57 minutes, the word came back, all clear, you can go. And the Navy turned around and left. You know, their battle wagons and their cruisers, and they all pulled out. Well, what they did is they marched in through here and cut off the communists and the supply line and everything, and they mopped up. And then they turned north, and they headed north. And this is when MacArthur, right after this, when he got fired, because they went to the Chosin Reservoir, and they started on a cross, and the Red Chinese entered the war. 10 divisions of Red Chinese entered the war against this one Marine division up here. And that's when Chester Puller said, you know, they got us surrounded. They can't get away now. Anyway, they got up in there and they fought like, you know, they fought like crazy. And they, you know, for the life of me, I can't even remember what the point was I was going to make. It's such a good story. I just felt like... Pardon?
Some lieutenant.
Oh, right. There's a picture here that was taken when he hit this beach. And it's a Lieutenant Martinez. And he's got his platoon, and there's a bunch of rocks and a seawall there because the tide rises and falls so high. And there's a big seawall. And it shows these Marines climbing up that rock. And here's this lieutenant. It's a classic picture. And you know, you never see his face, it's just his back. But he's gripping his rifle, and his tendons and his muscles are straining, you know, because he's climbing over that wall. And his foot is almost at the top, and you know his next foot he's going over. And so, man, he's just clawing to get up that bank, and his men are all scattered and right behind him, you know, maybe 2 or 3 feet, and they're just 20 or 30 guys right behind him. And the caption underneath it, of course, is the Marines don't tell their troops what to do. They simply say, follow me. Well, see, that's fantastic here in this thing of pace setting. And it's a classic picture. As this guy is climbing this wall, and he's the first guy. Man and gang, we're going out there and win this thing. We got 2 hours. Let's go do it. Now, if you guys will stick with me, we'll do this. And man, he is climbing that wall and it heading over his way. It's a classic picture. Oh, it's beautiful. But gang, that's what you do. You don't tell your guys to go out and win this. You take them with you. You don't tell your guys, listen, gang, what you've got to do is you've got to get out and do this thing. And if you'll do this in the dorm and this and this and this, we'll really have a good ministry. You don't do that. You say, okay, gang, let's go do it. I remember one story I read about the Marines in the Second World War when in the Pacific. You know, this one sergeant says, okay, gang, you see that hill? Let's go over and get killed. Let's go. And he was killed. But they took that hill. And see, it's not gang. Hey, gang, you see that guys over there? Hey, that hill over there, you guys go take that. Give me a call when you got it, okay? Man, those guys that get about halfway and think, you know, it's kind of hot around here. We're kind of unhealthy. We better stop this stuff. But gang, it's the pace setter. You don't tell these guys what to do. All you tell them is, listen, gang, stick with me. And a verse I love, I think it's 1 Corinthians, what is it, 11:1? But be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. I think that's 1 Corinthians 11:1. Be ye followers of me. And another place, I haven't memorized this one yet, but it says, you know, that which you have seen, heard, you know, things you've kind of seen in me, you do that, okay? Some of you know that reference. Where is it? I haven't memorized it yet. Pardon? Philippians 4:9. Pace setter. Boy, gang, your team doesn't work for you. They work with you. You are in this thing together. And here's a classic statement, this last little statement down on the sheet of paper. I heard this from Howie Hendricks. Gang, you cannot produce what you do not possess. If it's not in your life, you can't produce it. Man, gang, if you can't get out there and witness in that dorm, don't expect them to, because you cannot produce what you do not possess. If you don't have the courage, if you don't have the boldness, if you don't have the wholeheartedness, if you don't have the single-mindedness, if you don't have the fighting spirit, if you don't have the enthusiasm, you cannot expect anybody that's around you to have it either, because you cannot produce what you do not possess.